Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit about conservation as it relates to the farm. We'll hear from folks from Monsanto and DuPont, and Gary Schnitke will be here, agricultural economist. He and Dale Latz have been doing some work with the Illinois Corn Growers Association on something they call precision conservation management. We'll do all of that right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Look us up and find us online to listen to us on demand at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, offering financial products and services created specifically for the cooperative's member owners to meet the needs of rural America, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, point-of-sale financing, and risk management options, helping farm families succeed today and tomorrow.
Hey, have you purchased your tickets for the all-day agricultural outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana yet? I hope so, but if not, you can do that online right now at WILLAG.org. That's willag.org, or by calling this number, 800-898-1065. The all-day ag outlook began way back in 1991, and we have great years each and every year. This year, there'll be more than a dozen analysts there to talk about the commodity markets. We'll also take up block trades and variable rate storage, some changes that are coming to corn and soybean futures in Chicago. At the CME Group, we'll hear about the agricultural weather forecast and discuss dicamba, too. The all-day ag outlook is at the Beef House the first Tuesday of the month of March. That's the sixth day. We'll open our doors at 8 a.m. Central Time and run through the mid-afternoon. Be sure to get your $30 ticket right now online, willag.org. 800-898-1065. And the ticket includes your morning coffee and roll from the Beef House and your noon hour lunch also from the Beef House. Buy them right now. $30, 800-898-1065 or willag.org.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by
Busey. As a Small Business Administration preferred lender, Busey partners with businesses and entrepreneurs who bring vibrancy to the community. Busey, your dream, our promise.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online, listen to us on demand anytime you would like. The address is willag.org. Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalem. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll walk you through some of the latest messages from Monsanto and DuPont. I caught up with their representatives at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri.
We're here with Jenny Goodman. She's with DuPont, where she's a program leader for the North American corn and soybean herbicides, and she's part of the Performance Acre team. Tell me what that is.
Yeah, we really tie that term with all the comprehensive products and expertise we can offer growers to help them make, you know, really what are hundreds of decisions to help plan for getting the most performance out of their farm. So really that starts with a custom plan that does look at the unique properties of those individual fields and really the goals of that individual farmer as well. And takes advantage of, you know, kind of the traditional tools we looked at, as well as additional, you know, newer data technologies as well as part of combining and really understanding the uniqueness of an individual farm. Then we kind of move into those input choices. So from a seed standpoint, we're talking about which hybrids and varieties really performed. We do extensive local field testing to let you know what to expect from a given hybrid or variety in local conditions. So that's dialed in and really about getting, you know, placing the right seed on the right acre. We also talk about some of the seed applied technologies and some of the opportunities with those different trait options. Then we talk about weed control and really how to put together a complete and consistent herbicide control program. And we talk about some effective principles in general when you're thinking about getting good weed control, as well as talk about some of the increasing resistant populations and some adjustments we might make. Even if we've had decent success the last couple of years, I think we're often learning that we need to keep making some adjustments to adapt. Then kind of really to push yields on the acre, we start talking about disease management and achieving, you know, proactively foliar health. And especially those growers that really, really want to see, you know, what yield they can get, that's more and more a topic of conversation. Finally, though, we talk about local agronomists and how do you talk to the right person to make sure that you're taking advantage of what works in your area and have somebody that really, really understands you and can take all of those tools, but adapt them to what you need.
Is Performance Acre something producers use online to help them through this process? It's something that happens with representatives of the company?
It happens with representatives of the company, and I think really the reason we tag that term with it is to talk about all those areas of expertise and products and really stepping, you know, both from our team's perspective of handing people off for the right expertise, as well as, you know, helping a grower understand all the things that we can offer to help make those choices. And so they can find out about a lot of those tools online. Our website's cropprotection.dupont.com.
Let's start with the seed. What kinds of questions should producers be asking, and what can Dow DuPont Pioneer do for them?
So specific for a given grower is really to ask ask questions about some of the competitive tests that have been run, both which hybrids and varieties they've used themselves and worked well for them this year, but maybe where they think there's some opportunity to get some better results. And sometimes that's specific to, you know, something that, you know, negatively impacted yields relative to disease or weeds. And so that they might be looking at different seed applied technologies or different herbicide resistant trait options to help combat those things, as well as just, you know, some of the natural sensitivity of a given hybrid or variety to that. So there continues to be increasing data available to us to help, you know, make those comprehensive decisions. So as much as, you know, you can get in love with a certain hybrid, the truth is, you know, that hybrid might work really well under certain conditions, but there's a better choice, you know, under different conditions.
Farmers depend highly, I think, on their seedsmen to help them make good choices for their fields. Herbicides is a much more personal choice, I think, for them, meaning they have a more proactive view of how they would like to control weeds. What are the weeds that are most difficult to control, and how do they find stability in those products?
Yeah, so certainly, especially issues with glyphosate-resistant broadleaf weeds, so the water hemp and amaranth species, as well as mare's tail on our no-till, giant ragweed in some parts as well. So really what we've tended to say is it's about a plan to start clean, and a lot of times that's very important for a particular mare's tail, is making sure that any emerged weeds are fully burned down before we start. And that can start even with a fall burn down in some cases, or considering a residual to help prevent some of that winter weed growth to help set you up in the spring well. But especially particularly in the spring is making sure you have a good burn down weed application. But including with that a residual product with multiple modes of action. So really having something that'll get you through planting and allow for that next flush of weeds, your summer weeds coming up consistently, so that you can come in with an application that targets them very small and helps you get really good control there. And then with that, looking at maybe some new technology options in crop where we're having struggles, but also adding other residual products at that time to keep it clean up until, you know, complete canopy, and making sure that, you know, there aren't even, you know, small escapes that'll produce weed seed and cause us problems in the future.
This is more of the problem, and you've been talking, I think, mostly about soybean in this process. Corn too, though?
Yeah, absolutely. So soybeans has been the focus for a number of years, but it's getting harder in corn as well, and people are learning that, you know, making sure that timely applications, those same principles of residuals, multiple modes of action, apply to corn as well. And so we're continuing to make adjustments on both crops.
And finally, in season, fungicides, other kinds of products that producers might consider.
Yeah, so what we find on fungicides, you know, there's certainly choices you want to make specific to disease pressure, and it's important to make sure that those are timely, and that's all, you know, specific to the individual weed and crop. But we also are talking a lot and have had some good results with being proactive and really promoting foliar health in general. So that's another area that we continue to have good data to support. That is a consideration for farmers as well.
Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Jenny Goodman is with Performance Acorn, DuPont Crop Protection. We're here at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri.
Charlie Forsman, Sustainable Ag Systems Lead with Monsanto.
Why does Monsanto have a Sustainable Ag Systems Lead?
If it's impactful to farmers, Monsanto wants to be involved. So if you pick up an ag publication today, it's going to talk about cover crops. It's going to talk about no-till. It's going to talk about more precise nutrient management. And if it impacts our farmers, Monsanto wants to be involved. We want to be the farmer's trusted advisor when it comes to planting and growing a crop. And so these are places where we need to have some interaction.
Tell me about your involvement in cover crops first.
So in Illinois, we have a program with two separate retailers around having a cover crop experience. So we worked with two retailers, and think about their marketing area, maybe a 30-mile radius around the head shed. And we asked them to go out and identify 20 to 30 growers in that area that would be interested in growing a cover crop, because we feel like there's a lot of folks that are interested, but they need a little bit of a nudge or a push to actually take the practice underway and get the practice underway. And so what we did is we worked with them to provide an incentive to do so.
Is it worthwhile or experimental? I'm not sure which.
It's both. So it's from a benefit perspective, there are tons of benefits associated with cover crops. It just takes a while for those benefits to become apparent. Some things like erosion control, water infiltration, you can maybe see in year one, but improvement in soil health and yields don't come until years 3, 4, and 5. So there are some immediate, tangible things you can see, but then there's other things that come along with time and experience with cover cropping.
I know this would help folks that are conventional tillage that don't want to go quite to no-till. What's your experience between the two and how they stack up against one and another?
I think there's a time and place for both. I think in years where we have significant compaction, you know, we maybe need to do some tillage. But in drier years where compaction is an issue, I think no-till is a valid option, especially when I think about soybean systems. I see no reason why we can't convert more soybean acres to no-till, especially with our Xtend platform and being able to handle weed herbicide-resistant weeds much better. You know, in a corn-on-corn situation in central Illinois, you know, might need some tillage to break up that residue and to handle it. But so no-till might not be the best fit for there. But it just kind of depends on the cropping system and the environment.
The two places that you've been working with the 30-mile radiuses, where are they so farmers might understand that and be able to contact them if they're interested?
Yeah, in the Springfield area. So we're very interested in working with farmers in the key watershed in that area, and then right around Bloomington, Illinois, where we have very sensitive waterways. We wanted to maybe get a spark out there around cover cropping and fan that amber a little bit, and maybe we can see some growth in those areas to help not only protect the soil that's in place, but also protect some of those waterways and in those key watersheds.
And are you collecting data as well in the process?
When we started working with these farmers initially, we worked with them to collect a baseline because we need to understand where they're at today. In general, we focus on where this practice was new to folks, and then we hope to see some growth from there on out.
And how do producers that want to be involved get involved? Just make the contact?
Yeah, I would contact your local retailer. In some cases, they may sell a cover crop. The other place to go would be talk to a Monsanto seed representative, whether that be at a retail site or a seed dealer. And we've done a lot of research on our own around cover cropping and what works best for different situations, and they would be the best resource.
What's the take-home message here?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, we have significant opportunity within agriculture to tell a really fantastic story about how farmers are helping to improve the environment, but at the same time feed a growing and a growing population and a growing world.
Charlie Forsman is with Monsanto. I spoke with him during the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Of course, our topic of the day has been production agriculture, and in this case, related to conservation management. Gary Schnitke and Dale Latz have been working with the Illinois Corn Growers Association, switching topics just slightly, and looking at how well conservation management actually pays on the farm. They've done this for a couple of years, and he has some early indication of what different types of practices might be, quote, worth as it's related to farm production. I asked Gary about them.
So what we're doing is farmers that have enrolled in precision conservation management agree to input detailed production information about specific fields on their farm. So we know on those fields what time they've planted, what tillage practices they've done, when they've put nitrogen on, and yields and moisture levels, and a whole bunch of production factors. What we're doing with that data is looking at different systems and putting returns and costs to those systems to see if we can find any difference in tillage systems, nitrogen delivery systems, and cover crop systems, and looking at the economics of conservation practices.
Where are the farms? How many of them?
So all of these farms are in East Central Illinois. There's roughly 50,000 acres enrolled in the system, maybe even a little bit more than that by now. So quite a few acres in those systems, and they're traditional corn, soybean farms from East Central Illinois.
So 50,000 acres spread over East Central Illinois, a fairly large area. When you collect the data, let's start with one of the data points that producers will be most interested in, nitrogen application. Can you find different economics from fall applied to spring applied?
Yeah, so we're looking at fall applied versus spring applied. One of the things we note is that in the couple 2 years before which we have data, complete data, 2016 and 2015, pretty soon we'll have 2017 data available as well, but 2016 complete data. In those 2 years in which we have data, we see higher yields for those farms that have done spring applied in both of those years. And the economics of it turns out to be actually in favor of the spring applied. That's after you consider the fact that most fall applied nitrogen has some sort of NSERV or something along that line that adds cost to that system if you do less of that. And you can pay for another application pass in the spring and going for something like pre- and post-plant applications.
Were you able to collect economic information on cover crops?
So cover crops, as far as the economics of it, when we look at the yields from fields with and without cover crops, we don't see a lot of difference between those with and without cover crops, so roughly the same yields. That would say that most of you are probably not going to generate a savings or a return from cover crops to cover the cost associated with putting the cover crop in. However, there are a lot of benefits environmentally to cover crops, one of the big being that it does significantly reduce the nitrogen leaving the field.
And finally, no-tillers generally love their operations, or lack thereof, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Is there reason to think that they're more efficient?
So what we see here is we see in the fields that we have seen slightly lower yields, but overall the economics of it are about the same as more tillage. What we've been surprised about is the amount of tillage that we've seen on fields going into soybeans. We often see in this data 2 to 3 tillage passes, and we don't see any yield advantages to more tillage passes.
Oh, so what you're saying, and for those who are doing conventional till, they're just doing way too much tillage before they plant a soybean crop.
Yeah, what we do, and again, when we look at this data, we know how many tillage passes they've done, what tillage practices they've done, and we don't see any yield difference between one tillage pass or more tillage passes.
Anything else from the data that you found of great interest?
So we're just keeping looking at this, and what we do see is we don't see a lot of advantages to a lot of tillage passes. One tillage pass seems to have the same yield sort of things as more than that from the data that we've looked at.
Any place that producers can go if they want to participate in this process?
So PCM is still taking farmers, Precision Conservation Management. There is a website that PCM.org, or just Google PCM, or contacting Illinois Corn Growers Association will get you in contact.
Gary Schnittke is an agricultural economist on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. He and Dale Latz have been working with the Illinois Corn Growers Association on PCM, Precision Conservation Management. You can always visit that website to take a look at all the details and get yourself signed up. To see more from Gary, visit FarmDoc Daily at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. He posts a brand new article there each and every Tuesday. You're listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Find our programming content online and listen on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org. If you like podcasts, try using iTunes or Stitcher or the NPR One app. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
It's National Cream-Filled Chocolates Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1779, James Cook died. A British explorer, he charted and named many Pacific islands, including the Sandwich Islands, which later became Hawaii. In 1794, James Davenport of Philadelphia received the first U.S. patent for textile carding and spinning machinery. In 1803, Moses Coates patented an apple parer. In 1833, Gottlieb Kirchhoff died, a German-Russian chemist. He discovered glucose, developed a method for refining vegetable oil, and experimented with brewing and fermentation. By the way, his St. Petersburg factory could produce 2 tons of vegetable oil a day. In 1838, Margaret E. Knight was born, an American inventor. She invented an improved bag machine to make bags with flat bottoms. Her first invention was at age 12, a cut-off safety device that shut down a power loom automatically when a steel-tipped shuttle fell out. In all, Knight received 27 patents, but her creative genius never made her rich. Often she sold the rights to her inventions outright. In 1886, California oranges were first shipped east by rail. In 1903, the U.S. Department of Commerce and Labor was established. And in 2003, Dolly the sheep died. Dolly was the first animal cloned from an adult animal. And that's this day in agricultural history.
In the 1920s, U.S. corn farmers were still planting open-pollinated corn. About 1,000 genetically different varieties existed, and most of them were white-dent corn. A few were high-yielding yellow-dent varieties. They were popular throughout the Corn Belt and became even more so when swine feeding trial studies proved hogs did better eating yellow corn because it contained vitamin A. A Reed Yellow Dent was the most popular open-pollinated corn variety in states like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa. But the farther north you went, the less tolerant it was of the shorter, drier growing season. Well, the University of Minnesota went to work on the problem and solved it with a yellow dent corn called Minnesota 13. These two varieties, says Forrest Troyer, set the stage for the development of hybrid corn. By 1920, the double cross hybrid method had been developed by Donald Jones. Still, it remained difficult to find 4 inbreds good enough to make a double cross to sell. Henry Wallace, who founded the Pioneer Seed Company in Iowa, sold the first double cross hybrid in 1924. It was called Copper Cross. It wasn't until 10 years later, in 1934, that hybrid corn varieties even made a dent in U.S. corn production. Forrest Troyer says that year, 0.3% of all corn sold for seed in the U.S. was a hybrid.
And Iowa was the fastest growing, partly because of the work that the editorials that Henry Wallace wrote for Wallace's Farmer. And by World War II, by 1941, 1942, I believe 90% of the corn in Iowa was hybrid, and the rest of the Corn Belt wasn't far behind. Just a few more years, you know, that they it was an amazing thing once it got going. It was quickly accepted.
In 1934, that 0.3% of hybrid seed sold in the U.S. came primarily from 2 companies: Pioneer and the Funk Brothers Seed Company of Bloomington, Illinois. In 1935, Troyer says the first Ag Experiment Station hybrid was introduced, U.S. 13. A year later, Iowa 939 was released. In those early years of hybridization of corn, it was thought farmers would buy the original material and then produce their own hybrids. That's how open-pollinated crosses had been adapted throughout the Midwest, but the model didn't work for hybrid corn. So the corn seed companies prospered. Pioneer and Funk, along with DeKalb, were the 3 largest. These 3 companies and the experiment stations used the available open-cross yellow-dent corn to develop their hybrids. It was at this point that the majority of the genetic diversification of the domesticated corn plant was lost. Today's hybrid corn comes from about 8 genetically different open-pollinated yellow-dent corn lines. They include Lemming, Lancaster, Reed Yellow Dent, Minnesota 13, Northwestern Dent, Funk's Yellow Dent, and Troyer's Reed, along with 176A.
But over time, the thing that happened is that those inbreds that came from those popular varieties became the backbone of the hybrid seed corn industry. And what it really amounted to, as more emphasis was put on white adaptation of the hybrids, the inbreds from the varieties that did well over a more widely adapted area came to the forefront, and they're the backbone of the hybrid seed corn industry today.
Today, Forest Royer says half of the seed corn sold can trace its heritage to Reed Yellow Dent. Another 20% is directly related to Lemming, Lancaster, Minnesota 13, and Northwestern Dent. It's a narrow genetic base from which to work. He says it confines the ability of corn breeders to continue improving Yellow Dent corn. And in a world which is expected to grow by 4 billion people in the next 30 years, that could be a problem. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.